This podcast is for healthcare professionals only and is supported by an independent educational grant from Bayer.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Oncology Brothers Podcast. I'm Rohit Gosain, along with my brother and co-host, Rahul Gosain. We are continuing on our four-part series focusing on hepatocellular carcinoma, HCC, where the first episode was dedicated to first-line treatment options with Dr. Rachna Ashraf, where we discussed in advanced HCC how IO has changed their treatment paradigm, whether that's with IO and its own or combination with bevacizumab or other IO agents.
That's right, Rohit. Thankfully, we now do have more options in first line. But then picking the right treatment in second line gets complicated. With that in mind, today we're diving into our second part of this series focused on advanced HCC, specifically second line treatment selection and when to switch therapies. To help us navigate this complex topic, we're joined by Dr. Lorenza Rimassa, a medical oncologist and head of hepatobiliary cancer program in Milan, Italy, and Dr. Arndt Vogel, a hepatologist and medical oncologist, previously from Germany, but now in our hometown, Toronto, Canada. Lorenza and Arndt, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, welcome, Lorenza and Arndt. Before we dive into our second-line treatment options for HCC, it is important to reiterate the current standard of care, at least for frontline, which we are still heavily relying on atezolizumab and bevacizumab off of IMbrave 150, and durvalumab and tremelimumab based on recent approval off of Himalaya's tried regimen. Additionally, we still have sorafenib and lenvatinib upfront treatment options available. Median overall survival, unfortunately, still is less than 2 years from the get-go. So whenever we are thinking about this disease upfront, we are always thinking about this disease is going to progress. So we have to think about our second-line treatment options. Lorenza, can you please start us off here? It is a big unmet need. How are you navigating this landscape and second-line treatment option?
Sure, it is an unmet need. Indeed, we have phase 3 data after sorafenib. We have positive phase 3 trials showing that regorafenib improved survival versus placebo after sorafenib. Same data for cabozantinib, again, phase 3 in second and third line after sorafenib. And for ramucirumab in patients with a high baseline AFP, again, after sorafenib. So these trials showed that a second-line treatment after sorafenib was able to improve survival and other efficacy outcomes compared to placebo. If we start with lenvatinib, or as we are used to do now with immunotherapy combinations, atezolizumab plus bevacizumab or the STRIDE regimen, durvalumab plus tremelimumab, we don't have a phase 3 data in second-line. And so in the clinic, there is a real unmet need because we don't have a robust data based on which we can select the second-line treatment.
Lorenza, thanks for laying this foundation. And again, this is a good problem to have, to what you and Rohit have alluded, because our first-line treatment options have changed. All the phase 3 data that we have available was after sorafenib. Arndt, would you take a minute to add on this changing landscape and how, what options we have in second line, knowing that the patients have progressed on IO or IO combination, what are you keeping in mind when you're talking to them about the second-line treatment?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, I mean, I would like to start with a more general view maybe. And I think you can always view on the data that the glass is half full or half empty, right? And I tend to see it not as pessimistic anymore as Rohit just started off. I think we really have made tremendous progress in recent years. And I think we really need to acknowledge that. So in the old days, yeah, when I started 20 years ago, I mean, we had nothing available. And then it was just sorafenib. And for many years, the median overall survival was below 1 year. So, and I think having now phase 3 studies with a median overall survival of 2 years is some progress. I mean, we certainly can do better, but we have also, and I mean, Lorenza was the first author on that, 5 years survival updates, right, from clinical trials in HCC, which means they are surviving patients after 5 years. And we have just published a paper on recurrence-free survival for patients with immunotherapy in advanced HCC. If we report recurrence-free survival, it implies that we have complete responses. So in advanced disease. And so the numbers are still low, but we have made progress. Another point is we do not only have more effective first-line treatment. I think also some of the progress we are seeing at the moment is because we can apply sequential treatment. If you just take sorafenib and lenvatinib in the pivotal studies, median overall survival was just 11 months or 13 months. And with lenvatinib, we have now in our latest study a median overall survival of 20 months. And most likely, lenvatinib is not a more active drug, but the main difference is that we can now apply sequential treatment and maybe also treat our patients earlier. So I think we have made tremendous progress. We have more. We are starting systemic therapy earlier, which also implicates that we can treat more patients. And we need to think how we can best do that. And I mean, otherwise, I fully agree with Lorenza. We do have data for TKIs after sorafenib, but otherwise, it's an kind of evidence-based free room, right? So we really need to think about how could we best sequence our treatment. And I think this is something we want to discuss now, right?
Absolutely. Arndt, thank you so much. Yes, our patients are living longer because we do have better options. Lorenza, we have few TKIs available here, be it cabozantinib, be it regorafenib, lenvatinib, if you've not used that upfront. Can you touch on the practical aspect or what data do we have on either of this to support this practice?
Yes, we have a real world data and we have some prospective phase 2 trial of TKIs. For instance, for regorafenib, we have the REFINE that is a large observational trial, a kind of registry. And even after a reduced dose, for instance, of sorafenib, in the registrational trial, in the phase 3 trial of regorafenib after sorafenib, patients should have tolerated the prior treatment with sorafenib, and that was an inclusion criterion. Now we know from real-world data like the REFINE and also from other prospective phase 2 trials that also patients who were not able to tolerate sorafenib or who received other first-line options like lenvatinib or like atezolizumab plus bevacizumab, we have a few data after durvalumab plus tremelimumab because the regimen is newer. We will have more data after atezobev, but I think they can be translated and considered for all the first-line immunotherapy combinations. And we have data that regorafenib is active, effective, and also tolerable even after immunotherapy. We also have data for cabozantinib. We have a prospective phase 2 trial run in Asia that showed that cabozantinib after immunotherapy, again, mostly atezolizumab plus bevacizumab, achieved the same efficacy and safety results compared to the CELESTIA trial, so the registrational phase 3 trial. So after immunotherapy, the results that we can achieve with the tyrosine kinase inhibitors are more or less the same that the results that we had from the phase 3 trials. And the same is also for sorafenib and lenvatinib, because if we start treatment with immunotherapy, then we have the drugs that we were used to use in second line, but also we have the drugs that we were used to use in first line. And again, we have real world data showing that the efficacy and safety of sorafenib and lenvatinib are very similar to the data that we had from the phase 3 trial. So as I said at the beginning, we don't have robust data. This is a difficult area, but based on the data that we have so far, it's safe and effective to treat patients with tyrosine kinase inhibitors after immune checkpoint inhibitors. And as Arndt said, it's important to treat patients with more than one line because the survival is associated to a sequence, not only Absolutely. A selection of the first line treatment. So it's important. And then we can discuss how to switch and when to switch, but it's important to provide patients with all the different drugs that we have in a sequence.
Maybe I can add here briefly. So I mean, I think I completely agree with what Lorenza have said. I mean, we have all the data. You don't have any evidence to assume that any of the drugs is not effective after atezolizumab. But still, the question is, what should we do in clinical practice? And interestingly enough, I mean, even when we updated the ESMO guideline in 2021, we couldn't agree on a strategy. So, and actually, we had to include a minority report because we did not come to a conclusion. Some of our colleagues thought that we should shift the lines. Basically, sorafenib and lenvatinib should go to second line, and the old second line drugs should go to third line. I could never really understand that because I thought, I mean, we don't have any data for sorafenib and lenvatinib in second line. So why are they now the preferred second line treatment? And on the other hand, we have for cabozantinib and regorafenib data in second line. Why should they not be active after atezolizumab or STRIDE, right? So I always thought it's a little bit difficult to argue that way. And I think we have now learned a bit, and we have seen the real-world data Lorenza just mentioned.
Another point I think that should be considered is the different guidelines in different countries and what is allowed in different countries.
Yep, right.
Because I would be very happy to use lenvatinib in second line, but I cannot do that because lenvatinib in Italy, for instance, is reimbursed only in first line because the phase three was in first line. And so in different countries, different geographic areas, I think we have to consider the guidelines and what is allowed to do. And then overall, I think that we have some data to prescribe TKIs in second line after IO. I'm comfortable. I don't think there is any safety issues. That is the most important thing for our patients. And hopefully we will have more data in the future to select one drug or the other.
Maybe the IMbrave251 study would help you. And I fully agree. In Germany, we had the same problem about reimbursement of lenvatinib. And with IMbrave251, which I think will provide us data for two points. One is, can we use, and what is the efficacy of lenvatinib and sorafenib in second line? So even if the study is negative, we will have data for both drugs in second line, which could be helpful for reimbursement. And in addition to that, we will learn whether we can use IO beyond progression. So I think that could be a helpful study for that.
Well, thanks, Arndt and Lorenza, for summarizing quite a bit of here. I'll break things down here. First of all, coming down to you, Arndt. In regards to what you stated, we have come a long way from where we started out, and that has been the paradigm shift for every disease site. Patients are surviving, which is a great news. With regards to our second line options, at least from community settings, certainly you have to depend on the regulatory approval in each country. With regards to IO, now we are bringing IO in much front line, at least in localized settings. The question always is going to be, can we re-challenge them with IO? And then you combine that with CTLA-4. Any utility currently, Lorenza, we'll start with you, to add IO after patients have been on IO therapy already, maybe additional CTLA-4?
Yes, this is another open issue, open question, because we don't have data. But I think that if we start with IO-based combinations in an earlier setting, let's say in the intermediate stage, and then patients have a response and then progress, we can consider even changing the IO combination. We have some real-world data suggesting that patients who respond to the first administration of IO-based combinations may respond also to a second IO-based combinations, changing the type of immunotherapy. For instance, you mentioned the anti-CTLA-4. I don't think, again, we don't have data, but it doesn't seem that there is a cross-resistance between, for instance, atezobev and durvalumab. There is no reason to think of that. So maybe changing the immunotherapy can be an option if feasible, but we have even less data compared to the data that we have for TKI after immunotherapy. So I think that could be an option, especially for patients who have a good response, a CR or a good partial response with a long duration of response. When they progress, they can be probably re-challenged with the immunotherapy combination. But this is, again, an open field, and we need more data in this in this area, because really we don't have any prospective trial with data available so far.
And it'll be interesting how the trials play out, whether that's IO with CTLA-4 or even TKI combinations with IO therapy here.
Yeah, as Aaron mentioned, there is an ongoing phase three trial that is testing atezolizumab plus sorafenib or lenvatinib versus sorafenib or lenvatinib after atezobev. So we will see if continuing atezolizumab beyond progression, changing the partner, changing bevacizumab with a TKI will be helpful for the patients.
Indeed.
And this is the only phase three trial that is ongoing, but there are phase two trials that will give some data in the near future, hopefully.
Absolutely. And again, we're talking about active treatment options. One thing that should also be brought up during these discussions is best supportive care, because sometimes that is the best option for our patients in front of us, acknowledging that there are regional cultural differences. We're talking about regional cultural differences, even when we're talking about supporting guidelines. Arndt, I would love to hear from you, given that you've practiced in Germany, now you're in Toronto, ASCO guidelines, NCCN guidelines versus ESMO guidelines or local guidelines. Any stark differences briefly in two different regions that you've practiced?
I think, I mean, so maybe coming back to your first point about best supportive care. So, and in HCC, it's, I think it's a really important point because it's not just best supportive care, it's active symptom control. Because, yes. I mean, these patients have liver cirrhosis and they are at risk of decompensation for ascites, which could also be related to the treatment. So I think, I mean, oncologists really have here the mandate a little bit to also think about the liver. And I think, I mean, it's, again, active symptom control. It's a little bit more than best supportive care beyond what we do in patients without liver cirrhosis. So that I think is really important to mention. In terms of availability, when I was in Germany, I thought we have a lot of options, but we have also some restrictions. And as Lorenza said, in Italy, we cannot use lenvatinib as second-line treatment. At least we were not able to do it for quite a while. And then I thought, okay, North America is easy going, right? So, and NCCN guideline. I mean, everything is possible, right, in the end. I mean, then coming to Canada, I really learned a hard lesson. And I saw that the restrictions can be even worse than in Europe and in Germany. So, I mean, in Germany, we were able to treat really sick patients sequentially over up to 5-6 lines using all the drugs. Here in Canada, we have really restriction that we can only use like first, second line, and maybe sometimes third line, but it's already very restrictive in terms of reimbursement. Mm-hmm. And the guidelines, I think it's we are trying to be as open as possible. And I mean, as we mentioned before, it's an evidence-free room, but I think in clinical practice, we need to do something. And In ESMO, we try to be open, and now we are with the update, we will be more open than we were before. So we strongly recommend sequential treatment, and we recommend that we need to look not only at the efficacy, but also toxicity and quality of life. And I think then there are only small nuances, right? In ELCA, for example, they also have a guideline. And I think it's fair to say that. I mean, ramucirumab, which has phase 3 data, right? But should we really use it after bevacizumab? And I think it's fair to put a question mark there because, I mean, we don't have the data whether really VEGF after VEGF is active. So I think it's fair to question that a little bit, specifically since we have other drugs available. So I think the common theme for me is that all recommend sequential therapy, and a little bit depending on the guidelines, some stick to this change of first line to second line and second to third line. And some are more open and recommend any drug with phase 3 evidence.
Arndt, thank you so much for touching on that. And one thing that you brought up was being proactive in symptom management, be it from underlying disease or from our treatments. Lorenza, with that in mind, ramucirumab, TKIs, be it cabozantinib, lenvatinib, sorafenib, or regorafenib, can you briefly touch on some key side effects to keep in mind if you're using regorafenib, important for that step-up dosing, just practical aspects around these treatments?
Yes. So for ramucirumab, it's very easy because the only important adverse event is hypertension. For the other drugs, there are all tyrosine kinase inhibitors, we have some slightly different toxicities. For instance, for lenvatinib, we can consider that the most frequently observed adverse events are hypertension again and proteinuria, while for instance, for sorafenib, we have diarrhea and skin toxicity, the hand foot skin reaction. For regorafenib and cabozantinib, again, we have more or less the same adverse events, hypertension, skin toxicity, diarrhea, weight loss. So some adverse events that can really have a negative impact on quality of life. So I think that considering the second line, we have also to consider how patients have tolerated the first line. Yes. And how, in which clinical conditions they are. So if when we switch, patients are in good clinical conditions with a good liver function, Child-Pugh class A, for instance, they tolerated very well the first line, then we can select the second line, mostly based on the efficacy data. If patients are not in so good clinical conditions, maybe the liver function is not so good, maybe they are Child-Pugh B7, maybe they didn't tolerate very well the first line, maybe they had a hypertension with bevacizumab, then we must be more careful and consider not only the efficacy data, but as Arndt was saying, the safety data and the quality of life of the patients. Because we mentioned that we did progresses, and I totally agree. but these patients cannot be cured in the advanced setting unless a very, very small percentage of them. So the quality of life is a really important point that should be considered during the sequence. And also we have to consider very carefully when to switch to the second line, because in some cases we have a, let's say, slight progression, minor progression, maybe just the increase in a liver lesion, and the patient maybe are in good clinical conditions, tolerate very well the first line. I'm not sure we have to change. If we have a clear disease progression with new lesions, maybe outside the liver, then okay, we have to change. So there are different aspects that we have to consider, both when we have to change the line and which lines, which drugs can be, what are the best drugs that can be used in the following lines.
Thanks, Lorenz. And coming down to your point, as well as Arndt, stating that, first of all, we have to keep quality of life in mind, because this is a palliative care treatment that we are providing. So us as community oncologists, we definitely need to get comfortable with the side effect profile and managing that. Additionally, we have to treat the disease here, especially with the symptoms that come about. So our best friends are going to be interventional radiologists, rad-oncs, even the GI physicians. So this is a multidisciplinary approach, not just in localized setting, but even in advanced setting itself. Arndt, while we are getting close to the end here, your key takeaways from someone who's treating with HCC, any key studies that are on your radar?
I think the most important point at the moment is that we do have options, which is good and bad, right? I mean, we can apply sequential therapy, but it's not as easy as it was in the old days. I mean, we need to think. And as Lorenza has said, I mean, we have to take everything into consideration to make our decisions in first, second, and third line, which is good, and which will clearly improve our survival. And it will be even more in the future, because we do see that the IO-based combinations are moving to intermediate stage. So I think we will use systemic therapy earlier than in the old days. And with that, we will probably have more patients in second and third line. And again, we need evidence how we best choose the drug. So I think, I mean, my take-home message would be really that, as you mentioned, it's a team effort. We really need to discuss these patients in the tumor board. And it's never late to give up. I mean, so we can see cure in patients with advanced disease. They need to be reevaluated for local therapies, and they need to be monitored for any signs of hepatic decompensation. And with that, I think we can really make, also without new drugs, more progress for our patients, but we really need to discuss them in the team.
Absolutely.
Oh, couldn't have summarized it any better, sir. Lorenza, from your standpoint, key takeaways and any important studies that are on your radar for future?
Well, I think the most important trial that will read out in the near future will be the phase 3 in second line. So we will have robust data in second line. We mentioned the atezolizumab plus sorafenib-lenvatinib versus sorafenib-lenvatinib. But another point that I would like to highlight, you already mentioned, the multidisciplinarity. We have data that patients with HCC, regardless of everything, if treated by a multidisciplinary team, have longer survival compared to patients who are treated by a single physician, regardless of the stage or regardless of the treatment. So this is key. We have to discuss the patients with other colleagues. Arndt mentioned the compensation. I'm a medical oncologist. I do need the hepatologist or gastroenterologist if patients tend to decompensate, because it's important. If patients decompensate, I cannot treat with the oncology drugs. So it's a multidisciplinary approach, and this is key. And then we will be able to treat patients for a longer period of time. Now we have 20% of patients alive at 5 years. We mentioned at the beginning from the exploratory analysis of the Himalaya trial. This is unprecedented. It was even impossible to think of in the past. So the multidisciplinary approach is my key message.
Arndt, Lorenza, thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today on this topic of second-line treatment options for advanced or metastatic HCC. For our listeners, let us go over a quick recap. In this four-part series discussion on HCC, today's conversation with Dr. Lorenza Rimassa and Dr. Arndt Vogel, our focus was on treatment options in second-line for advanced or metastatic hepatocellular carcinoma. The data on rechallenging with immunotherapy in this setting is currently limited.
appreciating side effects that come along with these agents and considering best supportive care along with treating the symptoms for that right patient is very critical. More treatment is not always the right answer. Thank you for joining us. Make sure to check out our other discussions with Dr. Shroff, focused on first-line treatment option in HCC, and look out for two other discussions focusing on intermediate HCC. We look forward to seeing you in person at GI ASCO 2025. We are the Oncology Brothers.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to find out more, then please look for the Oncology Medical Conversation podcast under the account of Core2Ed Medical Education. Also, don't forget to rate this podcast, subscribe to our channel, and share it with your colleagues. Thank you for listening and see you next time. This podcast is an initiative of Core2Ed and developed by HCC Connect, a group of international experts working in the field of oncology. The views expressed are the personal opinions of the experts and they do not necessarily represent the views of the experts' organizations or the rest of the HCC Connect group. For expert disclosures on any conflict of interest, please visit the Core2Ed website.